modern Babylon or confusion, and call the people out of this Babylon as you read the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation.
People get hostile when you try to...
Oh, well, some people do, but then some people do. Put it that way, I'm not hostile.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Coming Out Conversations. This is Troy Fitzgerald with Secular Safe House, and I have the great honor of speaking with Deborah Armstrong. She is, not only was she raised in the same church that I was, the same cult, Worldwide Church of God, but her uncle, Herbert Armstrong, actually founded the cult. So she has a very, very interesting story to share. And she was actually raised in the church. So, Deborah, thank you so much for being on the program with us.
It's good to be here. I really like what you're doing.
Well, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. And I just really, really appreciate you taking the time. And I understand you haven't really done anything like this as far as an interview.
I've spoken about it quite openly with people I know, but correct, I have not done a formal interview about the church.
All right. Well, I'm really looking forward to this. So, for the benefit of you know, listeners who didn't have the experience of the Worldwide Church of God, go ahead and describe what was the culture like. Go ahead and share, because I haven't done a program about Worldwide specifically. What were some of the doctrines of the church, and what was the culture like, and what was it like growing up in that? And then obviously speak about your family and the connections that your family has.
Okay, well, I would describe the culture of the church as very strict. That we had a lot, very legalistic. We had a lot of laws and rules and things that we had to follow. Thinking and feeling were pretty much frowned upon. You were supposed to be obedient. And I think it was especially difficult for women because we didn't have any real power. It was forbidden for women to preach in church. It was forbidden for women to have any kind of leadership positions. Mm-hmm. For a while, it was forbidden for us to wear makeup, and that went back and forth, and from what I understand, mostly because it arose out of Herbert Armstrong actually having a disagreement with his daughter, Beverly, because she wanted to wear makeup, and he didn't want her to wear makeup, and she refused to take it off, so he punished all the women in the church and created a law making it so that no woman could wear makeup because his own daughter didn't want to. Wow. And she left the church when she was still quite young, was actually disfellowshipped. Much of his family was. He didn't have a lot of family that stayed in the church because, frankly, he was a tyrant. And a lot of the family just could not be around him.
Right. Now, you're Dwight's daughter.
I am Dwight Armstrong's daughter. He was the composer of the hymns.
The church hymnal, yeah. A lot of people will recall
the purple
that name,
hymnal, yeah.
The purple hymnal. And I didn't really know this, much about your father at all, other than the fact that he had written the hymnal until more recently. So
he isn't especially well known, no.
Yeah. So what was that like? I mean, what was the relationship that your father had with Herbert? And I know your mom, she had a unique relationship as well with Herbert. What was that like?
Well, it's such a long story. I don't quite know where to begin. But my father was his youngest brother. My father was actually a twin when he was born. His twin sister's name was Mary, and when he was 4 years old, my father had spinal meningitis, which the doctor said he would probably not survive, and that if he did, he'd be a vegetable. But as it was, he survived, but he was left mentally retarded.
Okay.
And so he was rather an embarrassment, actually, to Herbert Armstrong. His hymns, Herbert Armstrong was quite proud, and my father was a talented musician, but I think he was. I know a lot of people have criticized my father's music, too, but I really don't blame people for criticizing anyone in the family, although I would want to say that my father was nothing like his brother Herbert, and only maybe in a few things, in that he had the same famous Armstrong temper, which...
What was the age difference between Herbert and your dad?
I don't know the exact age difference. I know my father was 18 years older than my mother. He was a good deal younger than Herbert, I think maybe 10, 12 years. I'd have to look that up. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. And then he passed away a couple of years before Herbert did.
Yes, right. My father died in 1984. He was 80 years old. And okay. Herbert died in 1986, and I believe he was 92.
Okay. So
92 or 93.
Talk a little bit about your mom. I know that she had, you've told me some stories before about her relationship with Herbert and kind of how that affected family.
My mother came from a different family, a family in the Pacific Northwest. Her father was a Norwegian immigrant, mm-hmm. and her mother was actually an actress in what was at that time the port city of Port Townsend, which this was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And that's how her parents came to be. And then I guess her mother came into the church, and so then she came into the church. Her little brother was David John Hill, who some people will remember was a quite well-known evangelist in the Worldwide Church of God back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And he lived quite well. He was paid very well, I mean, for the time, and had a fine house and an expense account. And my mother, of course, was a little bit jealous and desirous of these things for herself. And so she came into the church, but it was required that she divorce her husband, who was an atheist. Okay. And it was they cited the scripture of how thou shalt not be unequally yoked. And so her husband's marriage to her was annulled. It was just not recognized.
So your mom came in as an adult after she had married this man that's an atheist.
She had to leave him, and then she was a single mother raising two daughters in the Worldwide Church while working as a switchboard operator for Ambassador College.
Okay.
Back in the 50s, 60s.
So how long had she been divorced before she met your father?
I don't know how many years, honestly, but she met my father because she was helping to take care of Herbert Armstrong and my father's mother. So she was very ill, and my mother helped to take care of her and became acquainted with my father through that.
Okay. So did your dad have any other responsibilities other than having produced the church hymnal? Was he in any kind of ministerial position? Or
my father was never a minister, and honestly, he was, I think, an embarrassment to Herbert because, as I said, he was a little slow conversationally, but he was a gentle man. He was a humble man.
So Herbert tried to keep him kind of behind.
He kind of kept him hidden away, tucked away, because he didn't want to be embarrassed by my father.
So what was it like as a child growing up, in that shadow of, the niece of Herbert Armstrong?
Well, I rather wish that my uncle had been Neil Armstrong. That would have been much better. I used to dream of being an astronaut when I was 5 years old because, as you know, the moonshots were going on at that time when I was little. But unfortunately, the reality was that my uncle was Herbert Armstrong instead, and it was... When I was really little, there was no real way to. I didn't really look at it negatively because I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Everybody, they dressed nicely. They had all these parties. It seemed like a very, GTA was a lot like John F. Kennedy.
So it was a little bit of glamorous growing up in that, because I remember as a preacher.
There was glamour.
My dad being a pastor, we had special privileges as, the minister's family.
And I remember sitting on Garner Ted's lap when he was flying, and he did fly one of the private jets himself. He had a pilot's license. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting up there in the cockpit and him telling me I was flying the plane. I was probably, 6 years old.
Yeah.
I have memories like that.
Right.
But there was a lot of abuse, honestly, that went on in the Armstrong family. And, my mother had a temper. My father had a temper, too. He was a good man, but he had a temper.
Yeah.
And because of his mental retardation, he couldn't always control his temper. And so when he did erupt, it was like a volcano. And he one time beat me. Just viciously beat me. I forget what I did wrong, honestly. I don't know what it was.
Herbert?
I probably dropped. This was my father.
Your father, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and
beat me till I was black and blue.
Oh, my God.
So and
was,
I remember
it wasn't just emotional.
It.
It was physical abuse. Yeah.
No, it was everything.
Oh, boy.
It was every kind of abuse.
Oh, boy. Oh, wow. Well, we'll get into that later. I do want to talk a little bit about the abuse with Herbert and some rumors there. I think it's important to discuss that. But talk to me more about your mom and what happened. What took her out of the church, and then we'll go back to some of your experiences with college and whatnot.
There was a big falling out around 1974, and a lot of disagreements. A lot of people left the church. My mother left the church during that time. Her daughters left the church shortly after.
That was
after.
The big rebellion, they called it.
Yeah. The big, you know, around that time. But my father never left. He stayed in the church until the day he died, although he wasn't, like, real hardcore about it. I mean, we left Pasadena, we moved up to Squim, Washington, which was a small town, and my father stayed at home. He didn't really go to church. There wasn't a church in our area. He would go for the night to be much observed, and that was about it. And he kept the Sabbath, and he didn't eat shellfish, and, you know, we had all these different rules about what you could eat and not eat. And
He
remained loyal, of course, but he was still writing the hymns, and Herbert was paying him a salary for that, so it might have been out of obligation.
Yeah. Do you feel your dad really believed in what the church was doing, and that Herbert was, you know, God's one and only apostle on earth, and the one and only true church, and all of that nonsense?
Well, for starters, I think Herbert believed it. I'm one of those. I don't think that. I really think Herbert, you know, he was so good at convincing people that he even convinced himself that he was God's apostle. I think he really believed that. I think he did. My father, I don't think he really believed it, that Herbert was God's apostle, but I think he believed that God was working with Herbert, you know, and him, and so I don't think he thought about it that deeply. I mean, to be honest, I think he felt a profound sense of obligation because Herbert Armstrong was paying him to write these hymns, and so he wrote the music. My mother actually was the one that put the lyrics to the music, and those lyrics came from a metered psalter, where it was I'm not sure of the exact source, but it was the actual scriptures from Psalms, which were then had been someone along the line had metered them and made them so that they were lyrical, rhythmic, then my mother helped him with that. But my father would just write the hymns. He didn't write them with any particular scripture in mind. He just wrote the music. So what I like to do sometimes, because I'm not involved in the church anymore, I'm not religious, I don't care to listen to the singing of the hymns. I like to listen just to the music sometimes.
Because that's what your dad wrote,
Yeah, that's what he really wrote, was just the music. And I like to listen to that, because if you just listen to the music without the words, without all that, you know, dogma in there, it's actually... He actually was quite talented, I think.
Well, as a tangent, I'll just say, because I know it's probably hard to hear people criticize your dad's music, but I think that a lot of the music was beautiful. I think what people do now is, a lot of us who have left, we make light of it because it was the only music we knew.
I know.
It was the only thing. It wasn't that big of a hymn. Well, I mean, relative to other churches, it was actually pretty thin.
Yeah, it was mostly my father's
music. And you
had
these same songs that you sang all the time. So.
Blessed and happy is the man. Yeah, I know. I know, and I had to sing them too. And I felt honored that people sang my father's hymns. I always felt honored by that. You know, I was in the church, it was very honor. I felt honored for my father.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That lots of people sang his music. I mean, especially at the feast when there'd be 10,000 people, you know, in Daytona, Florida, or somewhere, singing a song that my father wrote. I felt honored by that.
Sure, understandably. Did your dad? Was there anything else he did besides that for the church? Or I mean,
not
did he
really,
have
no.
any other work?
That was all he did.
That was his.
That was the extent of his.
That was his livelihood.
That was what he did. Yeah.
Wow. Once he produced it. Then he kind of went to retirement because they didn't.
He kept writing hymns actually up until the day he died, but they were never used because by that point Ross Jetsam had come into a little bit of his own power in Herbert Armstrong's circle, and I think he wanted his hymns to be used.
I see.
So there was kind of my father wasn't there around anymore, and he kept writing hymns. I have 20 some hymns which I'm actually going to probably give to the Philadelphia Church of God, just
really?
Because. Not so much to honor them as to honor my father.
I see. Interesting.
And because they had long ago asked me for them, and I had given them some of them. So there are a number of unpublished hymns, actually.
I'm sure they would be thrilled. I mean, as much as they worship Herbert, they would be...
Well, and that's the thing. It seemed fitting in an odd way. I mean, I'm not connected with their church. But my father, you know, he stayed loyal to that church until the day he died. So I'll honor that for him.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, so your mom, you know, you talked about your mom was a little bit abusive, and there's some pretty serious things that occurred. you even said she attempted to drown you, I think.
When I was five, yeah, she had a temper, and I think the biggest fights, we would always have fights when I was really little, and it mainly stemmed out of her getting me ready for Sabbath services. Yeah. And I had to look like a little Shirley Temple, and she would curl my hair and brush it, and it was like, she really was like the mom in Mommy Dearest. I don't know if that movie is familiar to any of your listeners.
Sure, John Crawford, yeah.
But she would have the Noxzema face mask and the temp rages, and she drank a lot. And
no wire hangers.
She so much craved to have the attention, and she couldn't get that, of course, because she was a second-class citizen. She was a woman in that church, and they had no authority. They had no position. They had no respect. And that's what she craved more than anything. So she was very angry. She was very frustrated. And I understand, you know, and then she had a daughter, you know, 20 years after she'd already had two daughters. And she, I think, was a bit frustrated that I didn't turn out to be a son, because I think she had wanted to have an heir that could be a blood Armstrong, a son.
So you have two older sisters.
To run the church.
Yeah. So but you instead, have two older sisters that are 20 years older?
Yeah, from her previous marriage, which
was
annulled.
Right, okay. So you're the only child of Dwight.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. The only one.
All right. So you come up into the church. I assume that you had. Did you have the? You know, I had the youth program experience with Youth Opportunities United, YOU. We went to SAP. Did you have that experience?
I didn't as much because in 1974 my mom left the church and we were kind of not as closely involved in it. My father stayed in, like I said, but was not tightly, you know, connected.
Because you were eight when she left, right?
I was eight when we left, and I had a lot of freedom up until I was 18, and then my father got sick with cancer, and at 19 he died, and Herbert Armstrong told me, I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of opportunities, because when my father died, that was it for our income.
Right.
And so Herbert said, if you want to go to Ambassador College, I will pay half of your tuition if you will work for the other half, and that was pretty much the only opportunity I felt I was going to get, so I took it.
So this was
and
about
that involved
84,
me having
right?
to come back into the church.
That was around 84, right? 84?
85. I came back in.
So just a year before Herbert passed.
Yeah.
You started going, you went to Ambassador.
Correct.
And
in fact, he died during my freshman year at Ambassador College.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting day.
So yeah, I imagine. So you, at what point in your time at Ambassador College, which was the church's college in Pasadena, California, and they also had a campus in Texas, but you went to, I assume, Pasadena, obviously.
Pasadena, correct, all four years.
And then was it after those 4 years that you went off to Russia?
Correct. After Ambassador College, I first hired on for The World Tomorrow, which was formerly Herbert Armstrong's television show, but at that time they had four different televangelists for Worldwide Church of God presenting the show. Right. And I was hired on as a script writer.
Okay.
And I wrote several of the different programs. Of course, I wasn't allowed to write the scriptural part at the end. The ministers got to add that part on.
Right.
But I had to come up with the whole thing. Like, for example, I wrote one about sexually transmissible diseases.
Okay.
Because the World Tomorrow, to familiarize your viewers, was a show. It was kind of like a news segment that they turned into, where they would bring up some problem in the world today, and then there'd be this editorial thing at the end where they would say how basically God will come and fix it all.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that was every episode was,
well, this is,
you know, divorce, STDs, wars, pestilence, famine. God needs to fix it all.
It's interesting. I didn't really connect when we talked before that you had written a lot of those scripts, because I'll never forget that transition when Herbert died and those four men took over the telecast. I remember feeling so proud of how they transitioned, and
it was a program.
It was a religious program it was a religious program like none other. We had a larger audience than all the others combined, I think.
Oh, we did.
Bigger than Robert Schuller's Hour of Power, and it was quite unique.
We had a very large viewing audience at the time. I can't remember what I have the Arbitron ratings written down somewhere, but it had quite a big market share.
Yeah.
For a news informational program with a religious twist.
Right.
You know?
Right. So you, and a prophecy twist, of course. So you were one of several writers, right?
Yes.
During that time. Okay. So then, so you graduate, and I'm sure you
graduated.
Could tell
I went
about
to work for The World Tomorrow 2 years for that, and then I had an opportunity to take part in with the Ambassador International Cultural Foundation to serve in Russia, and I was invited because I'd always had a maybe an unhealthy obsession with Russia. I don't know why. Maybe because I related to all the oppression and repression in the Soviet Union, and I had this strange, naive fantasy of hooking up with other people that would understand me. I didn't feel very understood.
Yeah,
worldwide. I was too much of a thinker and feeler, and I didn't fit in. I never fit in.
Yeah, well, you also obviously have a strong personality, which I think is a great thing, but that was not
Some might disagree with you.
Well, that's my opinion, but you know that wasn't welcomed in the church, and
no, especially not for a woman.
I'm sure your experience. I mean, my experience as a preacher's kid in the church, pastor's son, was different from the typical experience, and I would only imagine yours was 10 times more different.
And it's hard for me to know how it was different because I mean I talk with other people and I don't understand enough about what other people experienced.
Being Herbert Armstrong, I mean being a minister's son, the expectations are high.
They're very high.
You feel that.
I can recall a time at Ambassador College, you have to understand, I hadn't even been in the church. I was kind of a wild, wild teenager. I mean, I had a horse. I would gallop my horse all around and squim, and I was, I wasn't really prepared for the Ambassador experience because it was very suddenly restrictive, structured, rules, regulations. You have to do this, you have to do that. So I got in trouble for things like talking too loud. And gesturing with my hands too much when I spoke. I actually got called in and yelled at for an hour by
for
a minister.
Gesturing too much with your hands?
Yeah, and for singing too loud. And, and in fact, they called me vainglorious because I love to sing.
Well, they hadn't beaten you down through the YOU program. You kind of...
I didn't experience... YOU
you
or
just
RCP.
Being yourself, and that's not tolerated in that kind of environment.
I mean, no, I went to YOU and SEP as like a counselor during, or not a counselor, but actually an art teacher during, like I went to Scotland SEP 2 summers. I worked as an art teacher there. I didn't really want to be a counselor. They asked me to be. I didn't want to be. I wanted to be an art teacher because that was what I was better at. And so I remember teaching all those kids in that big sheep field. We had a big sheep field that they would rent on Loch Lomond, Scotland. And I really loved those international experiences. I mean, it was in the church, and so there was only so much of the culture I could really experience because we were limited and we were restricted and forbidden from a lot of things. But I will always treasure the travel opportunities I had. That kind of helps make up for how difficult Ambassador truly was.
Right. So you go to Russia after you graduate Ambassador.
After television,
1991. Okay, so... it was about a year or two after you graduated.
Yeah, I worked for Ambassador Television and for The World Tomorrow for almost 2 years.
Okay.
And then it was because of my television experience that I qualified, I think, for the Russian program because we actually worked in television in the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union still at the time, and Gorbachev was in power, and he had, probably some of your viewers will remember, Perestroika, and glasnost. Mm-hmm. These were Russian policies. Glasnost means openness. Mm-hmm. And he had opened up the Soviet Union to the West. And part of that involved a lot of joint ventures getting started, and Ambassador Television kind of started a joint venture with the Soviet government where I worked for Leningrad Television Company, or the Lentil Radio Komitet.
But that was under the auspices of the Ambassador International Culture.
Yes. It was the first...
For those listening, that was the church's... foundation, offshoot, funded by the church, but we did a lot of like
cultural programs. Actually, not bad programs. I think we had some good programs, although you have to understand it was all part of the church. But we had a program in Jordan, for example, where we helped handicapped children, children with Down syndrome.
Right.
And we had programs in Sri Lanka where they would teach English and so on. And in Russia, though, it wasn't the Russian program. Unfortunately, was not as well defined. Mm-hmm. It was very grassroots. We didn't know what to expect.
There's only a few of you that went, right?
Four of us that were sent.
Uh-huh.
There was me and a woman by the name of Darlene, who was a Stanford graduate, who had a master's in Russian literature, and she had probably been the main one that had laid all of the groundwork for the project, which unfortunately unraveled quite a bit once we were there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a couple from Australia who I had attended AC with and knew them both quite well, Cliff and Simone Worthing. And it was just the project itself was not, there was not a lot of direction, and really it kind of felt like being abandoned in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You know, but fortunately I had some very good friends among the Russians, and right. They actually influenced me to leave the church.
Oh, okay.
I think I already was going to leave. I knew before I even went to Russia, I knew in my own mind that I couldn't stay.
Oh, really?
In fact, I had this, because I never belonged there. I mean, I went to Ambassador College because it was the college opportunity I was going to get, and
I
tried to fit in. In fact, I had to fit in because you can't survive 4 years in an environment where your only contacts and your only friends are members of this organization and not become a part of it. So I think I really tried my best to convince myself that I believed.
Yeah.
You know, I really tried, but I don't think deep down I ever did, because I can remember once in Pasadena, I would try to get away from everyone. I would get in my car and I would drive, and I drove up into the Sierra Madres one time as far away as I could get, and I just started bawling my eyes out and thinking, I just don't want to live here. I don't belong here. I don't fit in. I can't possibly live up to all these expectations that they have, and I can't. I'm not going to be somebody's little Hausfrau and Proverbs 31 woman. And
now you have this opportunity to go to Russia,
and so I couldn't leave the church because I would have to lose that opportunity.
Right.
So I stayed, but I had all these doubts in my head, and of course they came up when I was in Russia, and it was, you know, very freeing, because suddenly there was nobody watching over my shoulder anymore. There was nobody, you know, saying, well, you have to avoid the appearance of evil. You can't be alone with anyone of the opposite sex. And all these things had been drilled into me at Ambassador, where we were not allowed to hold hands with the opposite sex. You were not allowed to date the same person more than twice in the semester. I mean, it was all micromanaged.
Oh,
and
suddenly
I'm in Russia and there were no rules. It was just, I was just free to do whatever I wanted. And, you know,
Of course, not really.
I mean, I wasn't allowed to just cavort.
How long were you in Russia total, and then how long were you there before you started really, you started exiting the church?
I was in Russia total for about a year and a half, a little over a year and a half, and I just usually round it up to 2 years because it's easier to say, but it was about a year and a half, and I all the time really had doubts, but they came to the surface fairly quickly. Because there were a lot of personality conflicts on that project, and the person that I had to room with, Darlene, unfortunately, we did not get along too well. She was very, I don't want to badmouth anybody,
sure.
But
you didn't get along well.
We didn't get along well, and it was, she was very strict and very, you know, she believed that she was going to be one of the two witnesses, and that God had sent her there. And that and that she would,
because
she worked in television,
you
see, it made sense. Yeah, and so she would be one of the two witnesses, and she would broadcast play-by-play during the final apocalypse on Russian TV, or something like that.
Wow.
And she was just very,
that's interesting.
You know, had this destiny that she was meant to be this whatever, and I just couldn't,
And you were this strong-willed college graduate that just...
I wanted to make friends in Russia. Yeah, I wanted to maybe even stay in Russia. I love the Russians. I really like them, and I had good friends there.
So did you actually leave the church while you were still there? Like stop attending?
I didn't until I left. I stayed faithful because I felt like they were paying my way on this project to an extent, although actually it was the Russians that paid my salary. But that's another story. It wasn't much of a salary either, $50 a month, okay?
Oh, wow.
Equivalent. I worked for rubles, so I lived like a Soviet citizen, which was difficult, remarkably difficult.
Yeah.
And but I had good friends because really, I mean, people didn't have a lot of in the way of material possessions, so they tended to value their friendships a great deal.
Yeah.
And my Russian friends, I grew very close to them, and I trusted them more than I trusted the people from Ambassador who I was working with.
Yeah. Well, tell me what were, you know, you come back to the States, but what were some of the doubts that you had that kind of led to your ultimate departure, and how long were you back in the States before you actually left the church?
I left immediately when I got back to the States.
Oh, okay.
I came back. I stayed one night at Ambassador campus, and then they kicked me out even though I had a migraine headache because I couldn't stay in the ministerial housing because they had a refresher program coming, so they kicked me out, and I just left. I left. I drove away. I didn't ever speak to them again. I left them, and I received a letter of disfellowshipment about a month later.
Wow.
Basically, wow. It said, so basically, well, Deb, we haven't seen you.
That happened as soon as you got back. I mean, the day you got back, yes. You said, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
And they said, no, you can't stay here one more night then.
Yeah. Well, I didn't tell them I'm done with this. I didn't walk up to them and say, I quit. I just disappeared. I drove off and I left and I never I never said anything to them again. I just ran. I ran and that, of course, sucked for me because I gave up my entire social network. And at the same time, I had to step away from my own family. So I was 26 all alone and surviving on my own.
Right. Now, your dad, of course, already passed away by this time.
Yeah.
Your mom,
What
was she up to with religion at this
point?
Well,
she actually, I hate to say it, but she went from the frying pan into the fire. I mean, after she got out of Worldwide, she was always a believer. She's still alive. She's actually very senile right now, has dementia. She's in a nursing home. And I do go to see her, but for many years we were estranged because she was just very, there was just too much abuse, and I had to separate myself from her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the most difficult things any human being can do, and that's probably why a lot of people don't do it, and I don't recommend it for anyone that thinks that there might be some way to have a reconciliation.
Right.
But in our case, there was simply, it was not going to be a reconciliation. There had been too much abuse. She would not admit she did anything wrong. I was blamed, in fact, for everything. And there was never any validation from my family. There was no support. When I told them I'd been abused, they blamed me. They told me, well, you were just a rebellious child, and you were an overly curious child. And they made all these excuses.
Damn curiosity.
So I just separated myself, didn't really have anything more to do with them, and it was very difficult. I had to work my way up. I got into television news, and that's a brutal environment. But
Where did you move to from Spokane, or from Pasadena?
From Pasadena, I went to Seattle.
Okay.
I did stay with my sister in Seattle for a couple of months until I got a job in my own apartment, and then I was done. That was it. I didn't really, and I cut off communication with my mother because all we did was fight. And honestly, I looked at it as a way of honoring her because I couldn't communicate with her without there being a fight. And so maybe it's just best for us all if I just don't talk to you anymore.
Yeah. Was she already having
it was very painful.
With dementia and that kind of thing at that point, or did that come later?
The dementia came much later, but I think she already had some mental illness going on. I think she needed somebody to talk with her that would have understood. And back, this was the 80s, or early 90s, and she, of course, didn't think there was anything wrong with her.
Right, right.
But she was very religious, and she couldn't just let it go. I mean, every time we talked, she had to bring God into the conversation.
Yeah.
And I told her, look, I don't want to talk about God. I don't want to talk about religion.
Yeah.
I don't care anymore. I need to move on with my life. And I was trying to take my own spiritual journey, and study many different things which had been forbidden before. I mean, all these other religions, where did they all come from? What do they believe?
So, yeah, talk to me about what were some of the, what were the doubts? I mean, because, in my experience, it was a lot of, what kind of triggered my crisis of faith was my relationship with God as I viewed it and how he had not answered my prayers about me being gay and all of that and hadn't taken that away from me. And then that triggered, me looking into Christianity more and religion because of the church going through the big split in 95 and changing their doctrines. For you, what were some of the key things that caused that doubt? Was it because of the craziness of who Herbert Armstrong was and all the abuse that was going on?
It was partially him. It was partially all the ministers, too. I mean, all of them were.
Or was it an academic thing? Was it an intellectual thing?
I think it was more emotional than intellectual, but it was also intellectual. I mean, I thought about it so much. And for me, I just couldn't correlate a loving God with the behavior of these people because they were controlling, they micromanaged. They told me who I could love and not love. I fell in love with someone when I was living in Russia, and it was utterly forbidden to me. Utterly forbidden because he was not a member of the church, and we were not allowed to date outside the church. I would have been sent home if I'd told them, so I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell anyone. I had to keep that all inside, and that was very difficult for me. And so I think after that, I just said, this can't be God. Not if God is love. I mean, there was this cognitive dissonance that was going on in my head because they're telling me God is love, but at the same time, they're treating me in a really hateful way. Mm-hmm. And so how can they then be representatives of God if mm-hmm. they're so full of hate? And so at first it was just Worldwide Church of God I got out of. And I right. still believed that there's probably a God, but I didn't know what God was. And so
what about Christianity? Did you feel
I
you
explored
were still a Christian?
It, and mm-hmm. I found I explored Christianity. I went to a few different churches, and I found that the same hypocrisy was everywhere.
Yeah.
And that the same abuses were going on everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that there was the same controlling, micromanaging, trying to tell others how they should live their lives, judging, hypocrisy. And I just said, this is no different than Worldwide Church of God. I mean, you may be allowed to eat lobster, and you may go to church on Sunday, and you can keep Christmas, mm-hmm. you know, but you still don't have love in your hearts.
Right.
So, you know, and they always claim that they have love in their hearts and that they're so full of joy, but if you look behind that smile, you find some of the most vile, most hateful hearts.
Right.
And I didn't want any more part of that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be around.
They'll say, well, nobody's perfect. But, you know, I find much more love and acceptance with non-believers than I do believers. And that's not to say there's not Christians or, you know, religious people who aren't loving, obviously. But, you know, I feel that religion breeds judgment.
It really, truly does. I think it's the fundamentalism of it.
It's rooted in judgment of others and comparing yourself to others or comparing others to this list of rules and all of that. Yeah. So you kind of dug into a little bit more the history, I assume, of Christianity. And you kind of did.
Yeah,
you disprove
I studied
it?
That. I studied secular sources. I studied different religions, and I actually was drawn to some of the Eastern religions for a while because they, you know, of course, teach transcendence and letting go of the ego and asceticism and all these different things. And I was fascinated, and then I was interested in paganism. And I actually have many friends that are pagan now, and I actually get along fine with them. They tend not to be as judgmental, and their religion is nature-based. It's based on the cycles of nature, and they view the earth as their mother and so on. Mm. And I can relate to them far better because they're not judgmental. They're kind. They have good hearts, and in my experience too with the gay community, I have a very close friend who's a lesbian, and she understands a lot of what I've been through in a way that is very rare, because she's been through a lot of the same kinds of, I mean, she's never fit in, you know, she's never belonged, and she had to hide who she was. She had to wear a mask all the time.
Right.
And so I could really, you know, I felt a great deal of love from her, mm-hmm. you know, more so than among people in the church. And they always claimed that they were so full of love, but there was no love.
Yeah.
There was just coldness and judgment.
Right.
And I think it's a problem in many different religions, but mostly in the Abrahamic ones, you know, which is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Right. I agree. So did you bounce around from different churches for a few years, or was it a pretty quick process to say, you know what, this is all nonsense?
It was pretty quick. I pretty much got out of the churches. I do sometimes, even now, there is a spiritual side to me, mm-hmm. and you know, I call myself an atheist, but there's so many connotations for the word atheist which I don't adhere to. It doesn't mean that I don't believe in that there could be something like a universal consciousness. There might be that.
Right.
You know, the earth. I mean, I almost view the earth as a living creature. It is our mother, and it is where we, you know, we owe the earth our life.
I agree.
It doesn't mean I worship the earth. It doesn't mean I'm gonna go to church and bow down and worship the earth. But but I do. I think that's the closest feeling I have toward God is when I look at nature. And I see the power of nature.
Well, I think you can believe. I think I'm glad you bring that up, because it's something I'm noticing as a kind of a theme in some of the interviews I've done for others and the ones I'm doing with people like you. This fear of declaring or adopting the label of atheist because of a belief in this mysterious cosmic force or the spirit realm. And I, you know, for the record, I'll just say, you know, I have that sense too, that I don't believe in a deity. I don't believe that God, there's a God like a personage.
A puppet Bible, master.
Nothing like that with some will. But there's something, obviously, something out there that connects us all. But I can't be dogmatic, or I would never try to start a church or a belief system around it. It's just a personal sense that I have.
And I did do the dogmatic atheist thing for a while. You know, I've read Richard Dawkins. I've read The God Delusion. Great book. But I think a lot of the atheists make the same mistake that the fundamentalists make. And that
they can be very dogmatic. Yeah,
they get dogmatic, and then they start insulting and ridiculing those that don't believe the way they do, and talking down to them and telling them they're stupid.
Right.
And to me, that just isn't, it's not, you're not going to reach people that way.
Right, and I think that's
why
so many people haven't wanted to associate themselves as an atheist, even though they don't believe in a deity or a God. They prefer agnostic.
Yeah, but, and yet I hate that word because that just sounds like fence-sitter. And I'm not really a fence-sitter.
Like, oh, yeah, but see, you know, after I published my book a few months ago, I kind of dropped the agnostic label because I realized I was calling myself a devout agnostic because I believed
devout agnostic. That's good.
because I believed so strongly and not being dogmatic about the existence or non-existence of God, but I also felt there was something out there, but I didn't look at it as the God of the Bible. And so I thought, well, I'm a devout agnostic. I was really proud of that label that I'd given myself.
Yeah.
but as I started connecting with more atheists afterwards and kind of looking closer at the term, for me personally, I came to believe I was kind of bastardizing the word agnostic. It truly means you don't believe there's evidence to know one way or another whether there is a deity, not something connecting the spirit thing connecting us. It has to do with your. So if you're an agnostic,
and
you're
by
saying
that standard, I would call myself
open.
An atheist.
So if you're an agnostic, you're saying the door's open that maybe I'm leaving the door open for evidence perhaps down the road that there is a deity, but I don't believe that's going to happen. So I gave up the agnostic label. So I gave up the agnostic label because I don't believe in that any more than I believe in magical purple ponies, as I say.
Exactly, or the great spaghetti monster.
The spaghetti monster, you know.
Yeah.
But I do, I wish there was, it's so frustrating because, you know, dogmatic atheists have always frustrated me even before publishing my book and getting rid of the agnostic label. But I am truly...
I think it's that dogmatic nature that's the biggest problem, and I'm not sure if it's religion that causes that or if it's the people that caused that originally. I don't know. What came first, the religion or or the people? I mean, the dogmaticism, has that always been there? Have we always just been, you know, judgmental and dogmatic as a race, as a people?
That's a good question. I mean, isn't God created in the image of man?
That's what I think. I think that, and I think that cruel people create cruel gods.
Right. Yeah.
I think they do. And
cruel,
that's why. And,
cruel,
and kind
cruel.
People create kind gods.
Yeah.
So if you're going to create a god, if you're going to believe in a god, make him kind and be kind.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Or try to. I know we can't all succeed, and sometimes, you know, we do our best and we're still mistaken and misunderstood. And, you know, but the point is the intent. Always look at the intent.
Right.
If someone doesn't intend to hurt you, you know, well, I guess good intentions pave the way to hell. They say that too, but I don't
it's
entirely agree with that.
I think
intention is what matters. You have to look at people's intent.
I agree. I mean, unless they're slapping you in the face and saying, "Just look at my heart. Look at my heart."
This is true.
there's a balance there, but I hear what you're saying.
But in Worldwide Church, you know, getting back to some of the abuse, there was a lot of preaching in the church to spare the rod and spoil the child. And a lot of kids were terribly beaten and abused, and it was not always physical abuse, but it could also be very strong emotional abuse, and that they were, they were never good enough. They were never okay just as they were. And the church, the ministers, they would rage and pontificate, and I can remember this from being a little girl, tiny little girl, lying down on the cement floor on my little blanket, coloring in my coloring book. And say, "Mommy, what time is it? Mommy, what time is it?" And then she'd get mad and take me into the bathroom and spank me for asking what time it was too many times. And she would spank me with a brush. She would beat me with a brush in the bathroom. And I wasn't the only one. The bathroom was always filled with other crying kids.
Right.
Because there was no Sunday school. We had to go to the adult services.
Right.
And we'd listen to them rage and pontificate about how foolishness is born in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. You know?
Oh, you're good at that.
Well, I learned from the best, didn't I?
Voice, Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, we were born as little evil, rotten, little rotten children.
I know.
Born rotten, evil, with evil, rotten hearts.
You didn't stand a chance. And if you're a female, you've got the whole original sin to contend with, too. It's like, you're not just you are evil, but Eve was evil, and therefore you have you are doomed right from the get-go. You're female. Well, screw you.
We're all screwed.
I know. I think that children need to be not have the crap beat out of them, but they need to be believed in and accepted unconditionally.
Yeah.
You know, and then that makes them better as people, and then they grow up to be kind.
Yes.
Well, they say, you know, a child that lives with criticism learns to criticize. A child that is condemned learns to condemn.
Absolutely.
And a child that's treated with kindness learns to be kind.
Absolutely. Spare the rod and just love the child.
Exactly. Spare the rod and love the child. I like that. That's how it should be.
Well, so what would you, now you're a hardcore atheist. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. I'm not really hardcore or anything. I think I've, at this point in my life, I mean, I have been hardcore, definitely. I used to get onto the atheist forums and rail at the Christians and tell them how stupid they were. And I just don't anymore, I can't do that anymore because it's just arrogant. It's arrogant and it's mean and you're not reaching them.
Right.
You're not helping them.
Do you know,
they're annoying when they come in and preach at you and bang on their Bible and judge, but you're not helping them.
Right. Do you stay active with, are you involved with freethinker, atheist, or agnostic groups?
On Facebook.
Do you consider yourself a secular humanist, or is that even?
Yeah, I would call myself a secular humanist. I like that. And, like in Russia, I think a lot, I learned a lot from the Russians when I was there. I mean, they were all atheists when I was there because of the Soviet Union. But funny enough, they still had religion in their culture. Whether they formally accepted it or not, they still had it because, you know, their views were misogynist. They were very homophobic, and they still are. And so you can see that it isn't religion necessarily that makes people this way. I think that they're this way, that they're just this way.
Absolutely.
And that religion is an offshoot of how they are.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know. That's my philosophy currently. Yeah. But I think that you have to be humble about these things, and you can't claim to have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. No one has all the answers.
Well, once you become dogmatic and think you know the truth, there's no more learning to take place. There's no more growth and understanding.
Yeah, your cup is full.
And this universe is way too complex and mysterious to be so dogmatic.
I agree with that.
So what would your advice be to people who are having doubts, questioning their faith at an early, maybe even at an early age?
Read as much as you can. Yeah. Learn. I mean, especially now, there's no excuse not to learn. There's the internet. You can learn anything and watch your sources. But just get out there and study and learn and fill your mind with as much as you can from as many different sources. And then, you begin to sift through it and realize which things are true.
Mm-hmm.
Which things really hold true, and hold on to those things.
Had you been afraid of your doubts when you were in college? The doubts you were having.
Yeah, I didn't dare voice them. I kept it all inside.
But did you foster them in your privacy? Did you research? Try to research.
I wrote in my journal.
Okay.
I had a journal where I.
But articulating those doubts to anyone there was no place to do that.
Well, no, because there was a real. Spy culture in that all the people that were encouraged to spy on each other and report anything that they didn't think was right. They were supposed to report to the ministry, and so.
Oh yeah, my dad had his spies. Absolutely.
Yeah.
People thought I was a spy.
I thought I was too. That's why
I had
Russia
no friends.
Didn't scare me. The KGB didn't scare me because I was already used to being spied on.
Yeah.
In the most intimate way.
So don't fear those doubts. Just embrace them.
Yeah. Don't be afraid.
And find people
of
to
it.
Talk to about them. Yeah.
Yeah, your mind is a powerful tool, and you should explore and question always, and not take what anybody says as absolute fact. Nobody has all the answers, and those that claim they do, worry about them, the ones that claim that they know, because they don't know. Nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone claims that they have all the answers, those are the people you should be careful with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because really what they want is for you to follow them.
What do you wish had been available? I mean, if there was something like Secular Safe House after you left the church, do you see a place for that for people who are coming out? Would that have made a difference if you'd known about
it? Would have made a tremendous difference. It would have been great to have had some kind of support group because, as I said, once I was disfellowshipped and once I cut off communication with my family, I was very alone, and I didn't really have anyone that I could trust or reach out to. So this all took place, I was alone through all of this, and it would have been great to have had a group of like-minded people. I mean, I had friends, I made friends, and that was where I got my support, was from my friends.
Right. But connecting with people that in a structured environment that's really designed to give support.
That would have been tremendous, and I think it's very laudable and wonderful that you're doing such a thing, because it wasn't there before, and it would have helped me out a lot. I think I really was so alone during that time, and it would have been really nice to have had some kind of community, because suddenly I had no community, and that had been my whole life, this community. You know, it was very structured and regimented, and suddenly there was nothing.
Right.
And so it was difficult suddenly not to have that.
Right. Well, listen, I just realized I was going to wrap it up, but I realized that there's a subject that I wanted to touch with you. Normally I would wrap up an interview at this point, but I want to go back to an issue, and this is, I think it's important to bring this up, and you and I talked about that I would bring it up, and I kind of failed to introduce it, but it's going to be more relevant to people who have been a part of the Worldwide Church of God or any of the churches of God that split off.
Yeah.
Because I think it speaks to the credibility of Herbert Armstrong. And, you know, of course, rumors, there's lots of rumors, out there about him. But there's one, and we're not going to go through a whole long list, and I'm sure a lot of them are wrong. But there's one rumor that I think a lot of people would be interested to know your take, and I know some in your family have a similar take. And it's a touchy subject, but I'm going to go ahead and broach it. And that is the rumor that Herbert had committed incest with his daughter. I believe for a man to present himself as God's one and only apostle and a representative of Jesus Christ on this earth, that speaks to his credibility as a minister.
And I'll
let you share, but I'll share from my perspective. You know, when I was doing the research for my book, Cults and Closets, you know, I studied various resources, and what hit me about that rumor was that no one had really denied the rumor other than, of course, Herbert. but even Ramona, even him, and even Herbert in his own, in the testimony in his divorce proceeding with his second wife, Ramona, it wasn't denied. And that lack of denial by the family, to me, speaks volumes as to the credibility of that rumor.
And, well, I'm certainly not going to deny it. And there's other family members that would, in fact, say that it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that they kept quiet for many years, mostly to protect his daughter.
Yeah.
Because she was still alive, but she has since passed on. And I have heard from a couple of different family members, including my mother and including one of Herbert Armstrong's grandsons, that it was, in fact, true.
Yeah.
So I personally did not discuss it with Dorothy, and she never personally told me that this is what happened. No one ever personally that was involved with it told me that it happened, but I very much believe it did, just because other members of the family have told me that it did.
Right, your mother as well, right?
Yeah, my mother told me so.
Yeah. Well, I think people can, you know, the message I would like to get out there is just people need to consider that, you know, there's a lot of that's been written about that, and it's not always just people, you know. I don't think the people who wrote some negative things about Herbert Armstrong were agents of the devil that were trying to bring Armstrong down. What they were trying to do was expose the truth. And I think there's this real tendency for people who, and it's one reason I'm really thankful that you came on to do this talk with me, because, you know, you have some credibility being a member of the family, and I just wish people would do some real research rather than just accepting that it's got to be a rumor and it's just, you know, the devil trying
to
influence. You know, people need to do their own research on it. And that speaks, and it's important because it speaks to his credentials and his credibility. And then that's the foundation of everything he taught.
He had some issues with sex, Herbert Armstrong did. I strongly believe, I mean, you can read his book that he wrote, The Missing Dimension in Sex, and you can see quite a lot about his issues with sex in that book. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was the one gift he gave me. Was a hand-signed, hand-autographed hardback copy of The Missing Dimension in Sex.
Oh, boy, what a treasure. Do you hold on to that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, treasure that book.
Got it framed on your wall?
No, I just find it ironic. That's the one thing he gave me.
Yeah.
You know?
I think sex was a major hang-up the church
had. It was.
And I think religion in general has that hang-up, but sex in general is just...
A lot of it probably stems from the fact that Herbert Armstrong was Victorian. He grew up during that Victorian era.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it probably stems from that culture that he was raised in, and very repressive, you know. And, as for his daughter, you know, she never personally told me, but other members of the family have.
But she wasn't out there in the media saying, this is a big lie, my father would have never done that, this is horrible.
No, yeah, she didn't deny it either.
Wouldn't a daughter, who when these awful rumors are being spread, want to dispel those rumors? You know?
See, that's what I think. I think
it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but on the other hand, she wasn't out there screaming that it happened either, because it's embarrassing. You know, it's shaming.
True.
And, you know, a lot of people, will shame you if you've been sexually abused. They'll tell you that you're damaged.
Yeah.
You know, especially in these religious environments where they have a very strong blame the victim mentality. They will blame the victim. They'll claim, well, you know, you probably came on to him. Or, you know, God knows how old she was, right?
But if you believe the rumors, it apparently started when she was 14. So, I mean, you can't see. It's just, that's the sad thing about sexual abuse, is the victim cannot break free of that. You know, I'm no expert.
And a lot of times the victim doesn't even understand that it was abuse until many years later, because they're too young. And your parents are God to you, you know, when you're little. They can do no wrong. And so when your parents abuse you, it often takes many years before you understand that, in fact, it was abuse. I mean, it took me many years before I could understand that what my mother did to me was abuse, and my father, too.
And then isn't there the guilt that you feel if it's continued past a certain age, and maybe into early adult, I mean, there's even more guilt if it's continued as you
get
older.
And then you tell people, and they call you damaged.
Right.
They tell you that you're damaged, and that there's something wrong with you, and that probably you did something to bring it on yourself. Because there's this stigma that gets attached. And it may be getting better now, you know, in the 21st century in this country, I hope, but... Yeah. In the past, it was actually very difficult, especially, you know, in my case, because my mother had abused me, and people, they don't want to believe that a mother can abuse her child. They just don't want to believe it, because mothers are supposed to be nurturing, and, you know, they'll believe it more easily that a father has done things, but they won't wrap their heads around the fact that a mother can also be abusive.
Right.
And they can, and they are.
Well, just for the record, and I'll end it here, you know, I just want to make it clear that neither I nor you are saying there's proof or evidence, but I think a lot of
And there probably never will be. There probably never
How
will
could
be
there
because
be?
But the people involved are gone now.
But, you know, you add that to everything else that Herbert Armstrong did. And
it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, honestly, because it just fits in. I mean, you hear all the time about these very religious, you know, uptight pastors that, you know, very well respected by their church colleagues and blah, 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 all these credentials and how great they are. And they're diddling whoever on the side, or they're, you know, taking a wide stance in a bathroom stall at the airport or whatever. I mean, it happens almost every week. There's some right-wing politician or right-wing, I guess that sounds political, but it does tend to be the more right-wing, conservative, repressed, closed people that tend to have these kinds of things going on behind the scenes that they're covering up.
Right.
And that it gets exposed.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, all hell breaks loose and people are like, oh, I can't believe that would happen. How could he? He was so great, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, but because he wasn't. Because people that say that they're also perfect are not. You can't, people that claim that they're so perfect and so much better than you and so much above you, they're full of it. That's been my experience in life. I find that people that are perfect are not. It's a lie. It's a mask.
The ones that are trying to present themselves as righteous or a leader, a religious leader or authority, are usually the ones who have the biggest issues. But
and yet they're the ones with the status and the success and the money, and so everyone thinks, well, they must be doing something right to get where they are. Yeah. And I'm not so sure that that's true. I think a lot of times in our culture we encourage very bad behavior. You know, stepping on people to get where you are, a me-first attitude. And so I'm not necessarily convinced that everyone who's successful and has money and status is so good inside. I'm just not convinced of that at all. No, in fact, some of my most closest friends who have the sweetest, most kind hearts, you know, they don't have a whole lot of money, and they don't live in a big fancy mansion, and they don't fly in private jets, you know, they're, you know, poor and humble and kind.
Right.
And I just think I think that as a society, we have to make some very deep, we need to make some very deep reflections as to what it is that we're encouraging and what it is that we're condoning.
Right.
And what it is that we idolize.
Right.
You know, and get back to idolizing things that are not even idolizing, but what's
about
the right
idolizing?
Word? Looking
well,
for,
how,
I mean, just we
how
need
about
to encourage the good behaviors, the kind behaviors.
Well, true unconditional love, things like true love, true
kindness.
Unconditional love, acceptance, tolerance,
yes.
Facts, really looking at the evidence.
Yes, questioning.
Rational thought, questioning authority,
feeling.
You know, all of that. Yeah. You know, when it comes to sex, I mean, the church is the last place I would recommend anyone goes to for counsel on
so
sexuality.
Many rules.
You know.
Yeah, and you
I mean,
can't.
I, look at me. I was repressed for I was 28 before I figured out I might be bi, and I had left the church at 28. It took me another 10 years before I could accept that I was gay.
I can.
And I had
I
left
can
the church.
That. Because
you know,
for your whole life, you were told that being gay was a sin, and that
yeah.
You
so
know,
even after
Satan.
Leaving the church, that residual effect it had on me.
Of course, it probably even now comes up in your mind sometimes. I mean, I could certainly understand if it did. It's you know, they tell us that we're bad and that we're wrong when we're very little, and that gets internalized.
Yeah,
it's very hard to eradicate that completely.
Yeah. So bottom line, Herbert had some sex issues.
I think so. Yeah. I think he had a lot of sex issues.
All right.
I think that's fair to say.
We'll just end it on that. Well, listen, I really didn't mean to end on that note, but I realized I hadn't brought that up, and it was something important that I did want to discuss with you.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your support of Secular Safe House. I know you've been really encouraging of what we're doing.
I really
that.
Think what you're doing is a good thing. I think it's much needed, and I really wish you luck.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you're a part of it now because, you know, your discussion, I think, will help a lot of people. So I really appreciate you making the time.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. I appreciate you hearing what I had to say.
Oh, all right. Well, thanks for being here, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Some voice has got to come in the spiritual wilderness of modern Babylon or confusion and call the people out of this Babylon as you read the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation.
People get hostile when you try to...
Oh, well, some people do. But then you some people do. Put it that way, I'm not hostile.